Welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silk and Ed in Edinburgh. I'm joined as always by Frank Agliano. How are you doing, Frank?
I'm great, David. Thank you very much. Yourself?
I'm doing great.
Excellent. We're about to go on strike.
Yes, we are.
But
our spirits are high.
Yes, that's right. Our cause is just and our hearts are strong. Before we start, David, can I say hello to a listener?
Sure.
We've got a recent listener, a new listener, who I think has been listening since around Christmas, Vincent from Wrexham. So, hello out there, Vincent from Wrexham. Thank you for listening.
Yes, thank you to
all of our listeners.
Yes, thank you everybody for listening. I'm always amazed people listen to our show. So, thank you everyone who is tuning in.
Well, Vincent is probably doubling our listenership in Wales.
We're big in Wales.
We're huge in Wales.
Right. So, this week, there's been a lot of news for I guess your man's usually Thomas Jefferson, but your other man, George Washington, this week.
I'm not sure I like that framing,
phrase, but okay.
All right, go ahead.
There was both the History Channel miniseries Washington and Alexis Coe's new book, You Never Forgot Your First, which you endorsed in last week's show. Never Forget Your First, thank you.
And there was a bit of a kerfuffle earlier in the week over President's Day in the U.S. over Alexis's book, which we might get to.
There was this
kind of online stromash, as the Scots would say.
Yes, but the third news story, I think, is the one we need to lead off with, and that was the one that was in the BBC that features you talking about a George Washington document here in Edinburgh. Do you want to tell the story for people who didn't see the story in the BBC?
Before we start that, I guess we could say, David, and this is a joke that passed over your head when I said it to you earlier today, but I'm directing this to our older listeners.
Older listeners.
Who might be Seinfeld fans. The episode of Seinfeld when George Costanza declared the summer of George. Well, I think this has been the week of George when it comes to George Washington.
Okay.
So if you get that reference, thank you. And if you don't, you're a youngster like David.
I watch Seinfeld. I just had other things
going on.
Summer of
George. Come on, David.
Anyway. It's small children now.
Well,
you know?
So we've had the week of George. But yes, I was involved in something. It was a very interesting experience. Elizabeth Quigley from BBC Scotland contacted myself and a colleague, Rachel Hosker, who works here in Edinburgh at the University of Edinburgh in the Centre for Research Collections, about a letter that is held by the University of Edinburgh, a letter from George Washington to the Earl of Buchan.
Hmm.
And this letter is a very interesting letter. It was written in 1796. And in it, and there's a story that appeared on the BBC yesterday and today about it. In this letter, George Washington is writing to the Earl of Buchan.
So this was right before his presidency's kind of...
Well, he's in the final year of his presidency. Yeah. I mean, the date of it was actually February 20th, 1796. So he actually had a year to go.
Okay.
He didn't leave office until March of 97. Anyway, Washington writes to David Erskine and the Earl of Buchan about a scheme to recruit tenant farmers to come to work at Mount Vernon and the surrounding farms or plantations around where Washington lived. And it's an interesting letter in a number of ways, not least because in the letter, Washington is sharing an advertisement that he drafted to recruit tenant farmers to come or prospective tenant farmers to come to Virginia and to work his lands. He goes to great lengths to say to the Earl of Buchan, who lives in the Scottish borders and is a great landowner himself, and these are both guys who have given a lot of thought to agriculture and the kind of science of agriculture in this era, to say, I'm not trying to poach people because that would be against the law. But if people are coming anyway, and if there are Scottish farmers who are migrating to America anyway, I hope they would consider being tenants on my land. But I'm not poaching them. And by the way, here's the advert. So it's a little bit contradictory, but this is in the aftermath of the Jay Treaty of 1794, and British-American relations are at a kind of, they're improving, but they're still in a slightly perilous situation, or fragile situation, I guess. And so he's going to great lengths to kind of do right by the law, by international law. But it's also interesting to me because this is the time in his life when Washington, he hasn't given up on slavery, but he's thinking about alternatives to slavery. And I think that part of his thinking is to replace enslaved labor with tenant farmers.
Okay.
And so I think it speaks to that portion of his life, and it's interesting in that regard. The other thing that's very interesting is, remember, he's president of the United States at the time. He refers to American farmers as slovenly. And he says, I'd like some Scottish farmers because they're not slovenly. They're very tight. And he doesn't mean in their appearance. He means in the way they use land.
Okay.
And to some extent, this is a reflection of environment. American farming in the 18th century is incredibly wasteful.
Yeah.
Because at least...
There's always more land.
Yeah, there's always more land. At least those kind of American farmers of European descent believe that there's an endless supply of land available to them. And to some extent, they're not wrong.
As long as they displace native peoples who are living around it and conquer Mexico and everything else. Yes.
But because of that, their methods of agriculture, they tend to exhaust the land and then they move on. They move further west and they move on to other land. In Scotland or in Britain generally, of course, the land is finite.
Mm.
And the farming that, particularly the amount of arable land is finite, and the type of farming that evolves as a consequence is much more careful.
Sure.
Just more careful stewardship of the land.
Is he doing this in a presidential context, or is this more of a personal letter?
It's
or
a personal
is it a bit of both?
Well, we've talked about this with the current occupant.
This may be the only time we're comparing these
two.
Yeah,
perhaps. It's a little bit of both. He writes this letter from Philadelphia.
Mm.
It's in his own hand. It's very carefully written. He's obviously labored over this letter. Washington at this point was, arguably one of the most famous people, certainly in the United States, but arguably in the Atlantic world. He's very well known, so his reputation precedes him. He exchanged about 18 letters with the Earl of Buchan during the 1790s.
Wow.
And the Earl of Buchan initiated the correspondence. It's a very interesting story. In fact, I think there's a PhD in it for somebody. I'm throwing that out there. But he's writing really in his private capacity, but at this point in his life, it's impossible for George Washington to do anything in an entirely private capacity.
Huh.
Just because of his level of fame, and he's writing as the president. He doesn't say, I'm the president of the United States. Mm. He says, I'm George Washington. He signs it George Washington, but, it's difficult to separate the two, I think.
Interesting.
Okay. It's very interesting. I mean, the letter itself is very interesting.
Is it? Now, I think some of the reporting may have gotten this wrong because it showed up in a couple of media outlets that it was sort of, this isn't a new letter. I mean, it's obviously a 200-year-old letter,
it's a 225-year-old letter or whatever. I'm glad you asked that, David, because some of the reporting and some of the social media treatment of this presented it as though it was a newly discovered letter. In defense of Elizabeth Quigley, a fine journalist for the BBC Scotland who did the story, she did not say that. Rachel Hosker, the archivist here at Edinburgh, who's a friend, did not say this, nor did I say that.
Mm.
This letter is in a collection, which I might talk about later, in the university archives. It's one of a couple of Washington letters that the university has. I can talk about the other one in a second if you like. It's been published in the Papers of George Washington, which is a very important series, and it's an incredibly useful resource for me, given the book I'm working on Jefferson and Washington at the moment. But what it was I guess we were highlighting its importance and its significance and the fact that what was little known, I guess, is that this letter and the correspondence with Buchan exists.
Mm.
And it was highlighting something that the university possesses, but we did not discover it. As I said, I was dealing with it with people from the press office and from other journalists about this story who really wanted me to say, like, sort of the Indiana Jones style, had discovered this letter, and that is not the case.
That's too bad.
And as I said,
that's the way all of our listeners envision you.
That's right.
Mannered professor during the day, but with the bullwhip and the hat.
I again hasten to add that Elizabeth Quigley never made this claim, nor did Rachel or myself. But it's been the week of George in all kinds of ways, not least because this week is George Washington's birthday. Tomorrow is George Washington's birthday.
Yes, happy birthday, George. But they used a different calendar then, so it's got to translate.
Strange that we're having a George moment, and maybe I think we're
so
going to
talk
about
why are we having, if we are having a George moment. Why are we having a George moment now? We've had biographies of George Washington going back to Parson Weems and whatnot, but there seems to be something happening within at least this year and the past couple of years where people are really reevaluating Washington on a more robust level than they have in a while.
Yeah, I think there are a number of things at work here, David. One is we can never, and shout out to Joanne Freeman here because she knows this better than we do, we can never underestimate the power and impact of the musical Hamilton.
Okay.
So I think that's part of it. So Hamilton has engendered this really widespread interest in the founding generally. And the founding, I don't like the term founding fathers, but for lack of a better term, founding fathers generally. But especially Hamilton.
Mm.
But once you start talking about Hamilton, you have to talk about Washington. And Washington is portrayed quite sympathetically in the play, actually, and quite heroically. So there's that. I think there have been some popular culture incarnations that are important. The TV series Turn, for example, which is available on Netflix here. I think it's Netflix as well.
Okay.
Is part of it, I guess. I also think that... I think the current political moment is a very interesting one. And if historians are always writing about the present in some way, shape, or form, I think the contrast between POTUS number one, as they like to, as Mount Vernon calls him on their social media feeds, and the current occupant of the White House is quite striking. Or, and I think one thing we've seen in the current political moment is an interest in a return to first principles and examining those principles upon which the United States was founded. So I think it does. I think the interest in Washington at some level speaks to the current moment, and I think the controversy, which I hope we'll get to earlier in the week about Alexis's book, speaks to that. So we might get to that. The other thing I would say, and I want to give a shout out to people at Mount Vernon, particularly Doug Bradburn, the president of Mount Vernon, which is Washington's home and a museum, and Kevin Butterfield at the National Library for George Washington there. The Robert H. Smith National Library for George Washington, I believe it's called. That library was created about a decade ago now, and Doug was the first director of the library, and now he's the president of the foundation that runs Mount Vernon as a museum. That library is dedicated to the academic study of George Washington and research on Washington. And I think that institutional support is really, really important and has begun to bear fruit. So Colin Calloway's wonderful book on George Washington and Native Americans, which came out last year. Colin, who's at Dartmouth, had a long-term fellowship at Mount Vernon, for example. So I think that kind of institutional support for the study of George Washington is really beginning to, we're seeing that bear fruit. So I think we're seeing kind of multiple tracks. There's kind of a popular interest, things like Turn, the thing that was on the History Channel this week, which we'll probably talk about. But we've also seen then the current political moment combined with this institutional support. I think there's a kind of combination of these three things together has helped to lead to this Summer of George. And as somebody who came to this as an expert on Jefferson, I mean, the International Center for Jefferson Studies at Monticello has been around for about 25 years, and we've seen that kind of institutional support for research has really helped a boom and a boom, and has been a boom too, and created a boom in Jefferson Studies. And I think we're seeing something similar with Washington at the moment.
I mean, one of the things that strikes me interesting about comparing the two guys before we get to Alexis Coe's book, which I want to see if we can sort of look at some of the detail, is that with a lot of the other founding fathers, the historiography on them has been kind of a roller coaster. You know, you see how Jefferson's been radically reinterpreted a bunch of times, and Hamilton's been radically reinterpreted. My impression, and tell me if I'm wrong because I'm way outside of my area of expertise, is that Washington hasn't had the same, until fairly recently, the same kind of roller coaster historiography that these other founding fathers have.
No. You're absolutely accurate on that. You're spot on, as our British neighbors would say. You're absolutely right. So Jefferson and Hamilton are almost like, you know, in they're forever linked to each other, and when one is up, the other's down. So we're in a Hamiltonian moment, of course, right now, which means it's bad for Jefferson. And historically, you can kind of trace this. I've written about Jefferson's reputation. It does ebb and flow, and when he's down, most of the time when Jefferson's down, Hamilton's up, and vice versa.
Whereas Washington's kind of a straight line.
Yeah, and he's above it all. So there was a wonderful book written about Washington by a British scholar, Marcus Cunliffe, in the late 1950s called Washington, Man and Monument. And it's quite fitting because to some extent we're stuck with the monumental Washington.
Sure.
And the monumental Washington for a long time hasn't lent himself or as a subject to, I want to be careful in choosing my words because there's some wonderful scholarship on Washington, but there hasn't been much scholarly debate about Washington. There have been big multi-volume biographies like Douglas Southall Freeman's sure. in the middle of the 20th century. They were largely celebratory. And Washington was, see, and I'll confess this as somebody who's been working on a book on Washington for the past few years. When I came to Washington initially, I was kind of that mindset, really like, okay, Washington is this guy. Not terribly interesting. He did a lot of jobs. He's kind of, you know, he lucks his way through the revolution, becomes president, but he's not as interesting as, say, Hamilton or Jefferson.
Yeah, it's not somebody like which of these guys you're going to want to have dinner with. Washington wasn't, you know, he's not an intellect. He's not the same way you would put sort of Adams and Jefferson, where you'd have interesting debates with them. Washington seems like he'd be very polite and boring. At least that's the stereotype.
Yeah, that's the stereotype. And that was a stereotype I myself adhered to before I started doing this project. I think he's actually much more interesting than that. But your view is certainly was the received view. And to some extent, that imbued the literature, is the point I'm making until recently. And I think for the reasons I spoke to a couple of minutes ago, Washington, we're seen this boom in Washington studies, but it also means that Washington's much more interesting than the kind of man and monument version.
Sure.
I think there's a good time in Washington studies because I think Washington speaks to a lot of the things that the other men and women of this period do in interesting ways, and we might talk about why it's worth it. Because one has to ask, and indeed my wife asks me this all the time, oh my God, do we need another book on either Jefferson or Washington, let alone Jefferson and Washington? And it's a very good question. It's a very good question. And if you're going to work on this area, and given the amount of kind of oxygen it sucks up in early American history generally, you need to be saying something newer. You need to have something to say, to my way of thinking. And it's a good question. But I think we're in a very interesting and exciting moment when it comes to the study of Washington, and Alexis's book reflects this, because there are new and interesting things to say.
Because I mean, I think she's very much, turning to her book, you know, one thing she's not doing is the man is monument
trope.
I mean, the first thing that strikes you when you pick up the book is it doesn't look like a Washington biography, right? Like from the color scheme to the font and the cover art.
Oh, the cover art's brilliant, but it's brilliant, Washington.
It's kind of like
it's whimsical.
If the thing you expect when you see a Washington biography is, you know, the very sort of dour. You either pick the young Washington or you pick an older Washington, but it's always sort of one of these.
It's the dude on the dollar bill.
Yes.
Or Wrong Chernow was the last big doorstop biography of Washington, and it's got a portrait of Washington. You know, man on horseback, literally.
Right. So there's you know a sort of received iconography of what these things are supposed to look like, and her book doesn't look like that. When I sort of first looked at it, I'm like, who is this for, and like, what is it? Because it's clearly trying to do something different than other Washington biographies simply by its physical presentation.
It's got listicles in it, which is something critics have fixated on.
And a recipe. It has a recipe for hoe cakes at, you know, one of the chapters, which, you know, most Washington biographies do not include things that you can then reproduce in the kitchen.
No, certainly the book I'm working on does not.
That's your next book, Founding Fathers Cookbook.
Oh, God.
That's going to sell great. That would be awesome.
And I think, I think that's very interesting. And what Alexis is doing, she can speak for herself, and she was one of the producers of the recent History Channel series, is Alexis is presenting Washington as a much more human figure. You're right, he's not the Manning Monument. It's the opposite of that book, to some extent. Although the Cunliffe book is very, very good at assessing Washington's image. And she's seeking to humanize Washington, and I think this is a moment where we want well-known historical figures to be humanized, not necessarily brought down. It's not about wrecking people or attacking them, as some people earlier in the week presented. But presenting Washington in full, he's certainly not a perfect person. There's no question about that. But she's seeking to present, a much more rounded human view of Washington. Mm. There are a couple of features of the book. I think the tone of it is really well written. It's really accessible. But I think that's led some people not to take it as seriously as they should. I mean, this book is built on a foundation of serious research, as one would expect.
I mean, and
one would hope.
Yeah, and one of the things she points out, there's a chapter where she sort of talks about the historiography of Washington. And one of the things she points out is a lot of those books are simply just sort of citing each other for things and, you know, aren't actually based necessarily fully in the archival record. And so, you know, I think she is trying to do a rigorous...
Yes,
book that does may not look like an academic book.
I would say it's a rigorous book. It's not an academic book, but sure. I don't mean that as a criticism.
Yeah, yeah.
I think it's a scholarly book. It's got scholarly rigor, but it is not a conventional academic biography, academic style of Washington. And she can write beautifully and she can write well, and so she disdains. I won't get the phrase exactly right. I'm paraphrasing.
Thigh men of dad history. Is that the
yes, name? Yes. So thigh worshipping dad history or something So and what she's referring to is the fact that almost all Washington biographers refer to Washington's thighs and his reputedly strong thighs. Now the guy spent huge amounts of time on horseback, so he probably did have very strong thighs. Although I also think it's a way. If you look at many contemporary paintings of Washington, he's very hippie.
Yeah.
And I think that this is a way of his admiring male biographers to get around the fact that the guy has got an odd shape. And so they're explaining this by his massive thighs. And so she makes this comment, I think, as a way of very amusingly summing up the kind of conventional literature on Washington. And she basically says, this is not a thigh-worshipping biography of Washington as dad history, the kind of book you buy for your father on Father's Day. It's much more interesting than that, to my way of thinking. And I think she's pushing back on that kind of genre.
Mm.
And I like to think that not everybody who writes on Washington, Colin Calloway certainly doesn't write thigh-worshipping dad history, for example. A lot of the people who've written about Washington and in the past and the present don't write that. But she's rightly critiquing, the dominant genre that arises from the thing you asked about earlier.
Yeah.
You know, it's impossible to write thigh-worshipping dad history of Thomas Jefferson because Jefferson's legacy is right out there and so complicated that those books it's not possible.
At least not anymore.
Not anymore, yes. Yeah, I mean,
there was a point which they were.
That's what Dumas Malone wrote, you know, six volumes of it in the mid-20th century. But that's not Jefferson studies moved beyond that.
Whereas Washington studies, at least until very recently, hasn't done that as much.
No, that's right. And I guess the argument I would make, David, is it's emerging at this very moment. I think Alexis's book will be a landmark in lots of ways because it will mark, it will definitively mark that change in Washington studies. The trend has been coming for a while.
Mm.
Again, Colin Calloway's fine book anticipates Alexis's. They're totally different books, but you know, is. But I think that Alexis's book, I think 2020 will mark this kind of change in Washington studies, which Jefferson studies had about with the publication of Fawn Brody's book in the mid 1970s, the biography of Jefferson. I mean,
there were a couple of things in the book that really sort of jumped out to me that are, you know, in terms of sort of breaking the mold of what we thought we knew about Washington. One is, and this is not a huge thing, but I think it's sort of indicative of where the scholarship was, about the way she treats Washington's mother. That the way, I guess, most historians have treated Washington's mother was that she was kind of shrewish and, you know, kind of overprotective, and George wanted to go off and be in the military.
Join the Navy. She wouldn't let him join the Royal Navy.
And you know, the way in which a lot of biographers do it is his older brother is the one who's really sort of his role model, and his mother is this kind of, you know, nemesis kind of evil character. And she said, well, actually, you know, her not wanting him to join the Navy is a good thing because joining the Navy in the 18th century was you know, potentially a death sentence. No, it's not necessarily a good career choice for a young
man. She wouldn't be the first mother in
to
history
say, like, don't
to
join
tell
the
her 16-year-old son not to do something stupid.
Right. And that, you know, in some ways he wasn't always a great son, and, you know, and so she sort of reads that character, or reads Mary Washington in a very different way than most biographers have, and it sort of reflects the sort of way she's sort of going back to a lot of these sources and reading them with fresh eyes.
That's right.
And I think, you know, some people have commented on the book when they've talked about this part, have wondered is the fact that the vast majority of Washington biographies are written by men, and she's one of the first women to write a biography of Washington, especially in recent years, that maybe have shaped that. She also highlights slavery and slavery's role in Washington's both personal life and political life in a much more central way than most Washington biographers have, and doesn't give him a pass for it as much as some other people have.
That's right. I mean, Washington gets, you know, in writing about Washington and Jefferson at the moment, clearly slavery figures prominently in the book I'm working on, and it's very interesting to see how posterity has treated both of them on this question. And because Washington, and this is very much the simple version, freed his slaves in his will, it's more complicated than that, he kind of has gotten a pass from a lot of historians, especially white male historians who've written about this, who've said, he's all right on this.
And who really like him.
Right, who admire him otherwise. And this is, you know, as he called it, the one subject of regret. I'm getting the quote slightly wrong, but... This gets his admirers who write on him around this problem, and they haven't problematized it the way they should have and the way Alexis does. And it's a complicated subject, unsurprisingly. Again, the contrast with Jefferson is striking because you can't give Jefferson a pass on this. No. It's so central to his entire existence, and there's the Sally Hemings aspect of it, and writing the Declaration of Independence while owning 200 people. You know, that kind of, or it's too complicated. I will say two things, and Alexis has acknowledged this herself. She's not the first person to do this. There was a very fine book published by Mary Thompson, who is a historian at Mount Vernon, who's worked for decades on the question of Washington and slavery, that appeared last year. And that's a wonderful book. And 2 years ago, Erica Dunbar from Rutgers published a book about the Washington's pursuit of Ona Judge, who was a runaway slave.
A book called Never Caught.
Yeah. But interestingly, the three people we're talking about in this context are all women.
Right.
And so women have written more recently and more critically and with more scholarly engagement, I would argue, about Washington and slavery in recent years. Sure. And people can reach whatever conclusion from that they like. There is a parallel with Jefferson studies, though, because the Sally Hemings story, the most important historians in looking at that were primarily, had been historically women, Fawn Brody, Annette Gordon-Reed, of course, and John Lewis, among others.
Well, the thing about the Ona Judge book, which is, if you're going to stock up on your Washington books,
it's a great book.
You know, Alexis's book, Erica Dunbar's Ona Judge book, Never Caught, is really a really wonderful book.
And Mary Thompson's book.
Yes, but it's that book makes it very hard for you to give Washington a pass where you say he's just a man of his time and he was born into a world with slavery and he died with a world with slavery, because it demonstrates him sort of taking a very active role to try to reclaim this enslaved woman who ran away.
Yeah. I mean, I'm writing about this, that's right, but Washington's complicated on this subject because he, I would argue, by the 1790s is more anti-slavery than Jefferson. Yet, he's this ruthless, hard-headed businessman who's very concerned about what he sees as his property. And so Ona Judge steals his property herself, as he sees it. And therefore, he's determined to get her back, even though he's acknowledged privately, this isn't right. His legacy and his will is complicated. His will is important because he does... See, he can't free Martha Washington's slaves in his will because he doesn't own them.
Sure.
And there are approximately half the slaves at Mount Vernon or more. And so it's a complicated situation. And of course, over 30 years of marriage, those enslaved people have intermarried, of course, and formed families. So it's a very complicated situation. But you're right. It's very... His anti-slavery is complicated because to my reading of the situation, such as it is, it's qualified by, greed might be the wrong word, but greed might be the right word, actually.
And, even if he has anti-slavery thoughts from time to time, or even fairly regularly, the way that actually informs his actions is interesting. And one of the things she points out is that he's, one of the things earlier biographers said, he was a good slaveholder. And she sort of lays out the fact that, and other historians have done this very recently as well, he was violent with his slaves the way that all most slaveholders were. And so you can't sort of write him off as being, you know, a benign slave owner. He was a...
Well, and this, as you well know, the concept of the benign slaveholder is a problematic one anyway, but you're absolutely right. He resorts to physical punishment. He will have enslaved people sold away if he as a punishment to the West Indies, which is effectively a death sentence. So yes. That's how, what it is believed to be. You know, in that, so there's an interesting contrast. This is where putting Washington and Jefferson side by side, I hope I'm saying something new. Putting them side by side, does we see each of them in a different light. Jefferson is less willing to resort to physical punishment than Washington. There's no question about that. Yet, at the end of his life, by the end of his life, he's more wedded to slavery as an institution than Washington was.
He also lived 20-something years longer.
Yes, well, he was younger.
So there's a slightly different time.
Right, but Jefferson does nothing like Washington. And, I mean, because of legal changes in Virginia, he couldn't free them in his will in the same way, but he was in debt and couldn't afford to. We know all the reasons. But putting them side by side yields...
Interesting.
You see each of them in a slightly different light. Neither is, he's a good guy when it comes to slavery. Well,
there's interesting parallels in terms of the way the biographers have treated Washington and the ways in which they've increasingly recognized both the centrality of his slave owning and the brutality of slave owning with biographies of Robert E. Lee, who was actually Washington's distant relative.
And Douglas Southall Freeman was a biographer of both of them.
Because, you know, with Lee, people used to say, he was a slaveholder, but it wasn't all that important to him.
Or he was a Christian gentleman.
He was a very kind slaveholder, and people have written about Lee and slaveholding recently have pointed out he was actually a fairly brutal slaveholder and physically engaged in whipping of slaves himself and actively tried to keep people enslaved who probably legally should have had a right to be free. And, and I think there's an interesting parallel there. So along with Alexis's book out this week, there was a really interesting three-part mini-series on the History Channel. And I know, Frank, you didn't have a chance to watch it. I only got a chance to watch the first episode. But, one of the things I thought was really interesting about it, besides the fact that it was on the History Channel, which...
They actually did something on history.
Yeah, I know. I watched the first... And the commercials were all about, ancient aliens and Ice Road something or other. And
Ice Road truckers, hoarders.
And Pawn Stars is the other... Yeah, so, it was unclear exactly why... but they got all the right people to be on this miniseries. So I was just sort of writing down the names of the people I saw. Alan Taylor, who I think you've met.
I'm familiar with Alan.
Annette Gordon-Reed, Joanne Freeman, Doug Bradburn, Colin Calloway, whose book on as you mentioned earlier, Washington and Native Americans, I think just won the George Washington Book Prize.
Yeah, last year.
Joe Ellis was in there, and Erica Dunbar, and Alexis Coe, who she's actually was a fairly central figure in all of this. And one of the things that they sort of opened up this miniseries with was that, in some ways we all know Washington, on the other hand, we don't really know Washington. And I think they were trying to present a much more, in Alexis Coe's book, a much more human and conflicted and problematic figure than the sort of monument figure we're used to. And they start off with him in the French and Indian War and basically all the things that he did badly. And I think the sort of flawless George Washington that I think people are used to is really complicated by this miniseries.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's... I haven't seen it yet, I have to confess, because unlike you, I don't traffic in these Russian street fights. I respect the law, David.
I've been at great lengths, Frank, to access documentary film.
No, I haven't seen it because of the time difference and because it hasn't aired here yet. But I know, in fact, I know almost all the people you named.
Yes, that's what I figured.
And some quite well, and they're I consider them friends. And I know it's been well received by many people, and it does what you say it does, which is great. The young Washington, I think the young Washington's a fascinating character in all kinds of ways because, when he's blundering about in the early days of the Seven Years' War, he's in his early 20s.
I think that's the thing people forget.
Yeah, he's a young guy.
And he basically starts a world
with
war.
With massive, amazing thighs.
Riding around on his horse, you know. But, you know, his ambition is very clear from the very beginning, you know. And there's often, I guess, the sort of stereotype we have of Washington is of sort of a retiring figure who would rather not be in charge of things and always wants to go back to Mount Vernon. But the 22-year-old George Washington is about as ambitious as you can get.
He's a man on the make. He's very ambitious. He's inexperienced. He makes mistakes because young guys make mistakes.
Yes. He should have studied French. That there's a big scene where had he learned French.
When he signs the thing about assassinating the French officer, where he cops to that. It's complicated.
Study French, dear listeners. Yes. If you're ever going to go to war.
Or study something. Study foreign language. Study another language. And he's got a temper. I mean, young Washington is fascinating because, and Stephen Brummel, who's written a lot of very good work on Washington, has written about.
I'm pretty sure he's in the documentary.
Yeah, too. That's good because he really knows the young Washington in particular very well. And I think young Washington's fascinating because he's not a monument yet, and he's unfinished, and he's a real hard ass. The one thing people, I think. And again, the contrast with Jefferson here is quite striking. Washington's a hard man, to use the British expression. Mm. I mean, he will kill people. And he has soldiers executed when he's not insubordination, but for dereliction of duty and infractions when he's commanding the Virginia Regiment. He comes from a, you know, we see him as the guy on the dollar bill, but that's a mistake for a lot of his life. Mm. He's got a fantastic temper that he's always struggling to control, among other things. So he's,
And I think they show all that really, really great. Well. They do show the a scene of him sort of yelling at all of his soldiers for not loading their weapons fast enough and executing somebody else for a desertion and as a father of the country, he's not the kind father. He's more of the sort of domineering.
He grows into the father of his country role. He grows into that. I mean, he's not the father of anything when he's 24 years old.
That's true.
Except for causing the 7 years
of war. Yes. Oops.
I look forward to seeing that. Yeah. And it does seem to be a blend of the scholarly and the dramatic because there are reconstructions of it as well.
Yes, yes. So
how did you feel as somebody who knows, you're not a specialist in this period, but you know a bit about American history.
I'm familiar with some of these things. So, I mean, there was nothing in there that I said, ooh, I didn't know that before, because I think I'd read enough about Washington at various points in time. The stories were ones that I knew, but I think they were in terms of presenting that to a public audience in a way that would be entertaining. The fact that this was on the History Channel and not on, say, PBS, I think it attracts a different demographic, and they were able to do it in a way that would appeal to somebody who's going to watch Ice Road Truckers next or whatever it is that's going to air immediately thereafter. It was, both intellectually rigorous. But it's not necessarily it's not the Washington, if you watched it closely, it's not the Washington I think a lot of people would want to, that people who are dad history aficionados want to see.
Who might have tuned in, yeah, that's right. And that's why I think it makes an important intervention. I would say two things. I think we need to talk about the controversy surrounding Alexis's book in a minute. But one other historian we should mention is a young historian who's working on Washington and has a fine book coming out about Washington's administration and his cabinet is Lindsay Chervinsky,
In the I think she was in the episodes I haven't had a chance to watch.
Right, yet, so. But Lindsay deserves a mention as well. I think. But in terms of the controversy, Alexis's book has generated a little bit of controversy in the past week. Because it was attacked both in print in the New York Post and in the Daily Mail Online. And then trolls picked this up and Alexis was subject to some pretty unpleasant treatment on Twitter and other forums. Because people who frankly hadn't read the book accused it. They accused her of attacking Washington. Saying he was
a liar was
he was a liar and he was illiterate and a whole host of other things. Now the book is a warts and all biography written in a breezy style. Now, I think that's a wonderful thing. It's scholarly, you know, the scholarship is impeccable. So I don't think it warrants that criticism. But because it's critical, and frankly, because it was published by, written by a woman.
And a younger woman, and
in part because of the presentation, you know, the cover image is
people think that might be disrespectful or something.
And I think that there was a backlash against the book. You know, Colin Calloway's book.
Yes.
You can't write about Washington and Native Americans and make it flattering to Washington necessarily. No. You know, Colin's book is critical of Washington, but Colin was not subjective. Colin won the George Washington Book Prize last year.
Colin's also considerably older than she is and ensconced in a, you know, established chair. He's at Dartmouth?
Dartmouth, that's right. So Alexis was subject to a lot of abuse, entirely unwarranted abuse, to my way of thinking, and because of who she is, I think, and combined with a superficial non-reading of her book, in ways that were really revealing again about this current moment.
Yeah.
And so the kind of people who might tune into the miniseries and be surprised and maybe unsettled by it, some of them were even more unsettled or have been more unsettled by her book and by her, I think.
Yes.
You know, and I think that many of the historians who you named who are in the series, I would imagine most of the women have been subjected at one time or another to similar treatment.
I think all of them have, yes.
And I don't think, for example, Alan Taylor or Joe Ellis or Colin Calloway have been.
No.
So our listeners can reach whatever conclusions they want from that.
Well, I think the conclusion is obvious.
Yeah, I mean, I'm right. My book is, it's not done yet, but it's... but it's not going to be...
It's forthcoming.
It's forthcoming. let's say it's forthcoming. Isn't necessarily flattering of both Washington and Jefferson, but I don't expect it's...
You're not going to get as much hate mail.
Maybe I will, maybe I won't.
You got a lot of postage for hate mail over here, so you got to...
Yeah. You know, so it's... And so I think the conclusion one can reach is clear about that. I will speak up, not necessarily for dad history, but for writing about these figures.
Okay. Because... Do we need more? I mean, obviously, if books that say something new. Okay, but as a genre of stuff, if you go to the bookstore, there are lots of these biographies that they sell really well. What's the argument? We need more of this?
Okay, I mean, and
especially when you're doing, you know, Washington and Jefferson. I think lots of people figure they've already got 12 of these books.
Okay, I mean, this is something I think about all the time.
As you should.
As I should, because I'm doing it. First of all, there is no book on Washington and Jefferson.
Okay.
And whenever I tell people that, they say, oh, really? I mean, there are books about the founders. Yes, Joe Ellis has written several incarnations of it. But on this relationship, and I think the relationship is important. The case I make in the book is it's important because they represent two different kind of visions of what America should be and what the revolution should be about and so on and so forth. I don't need to get into that now. But you ask a good question, and you ask a question I do grapple with, because Alexis has one virtue of being outside of the academy.
Mm.
It's very difficult to do this work within the academy because people don't necessarily take it seriously or take you seriously if you do it. That's, woe is me, it's not a big major problem, but it is something that I think about. The case for it, for doing this kind of work, is the following. For good or ill... And we've had a discussion about this when we had our discussion about David McCulloch's most recent book last summer, resulting in a critical email to you from my brother, of all people.
Oh, yes.
But that's... anyway.
Yeah, I'm taking emails from all people.
Our listener, David from Natick. Yeah, yeah. The case for it is, when you write on this subject matter, you have the ability to reach a wider audience with important ideas. So I think there's something to be said, and if we just cede the territory to people, and I'm not I don't consider Alexis in this category, but people writing thigh worshipping dad history, then recycling the same stories, recycling the same ideas, we get nowhere. And you know, you walk by airport bookstores, you see those books, you know the books I'm talking about.
The Ron Chernow.
Yeah. No, I don't want to name authors. I don't think that's invidious and unfair. But you know the books. That's not what we don't need that, but that's what we get if we if we don't do this. And we're also missing an opportunity. I mean, look, many, many people, and many of the people listening to this, and not just people listening to this, many of our scholarly sisters and brothers, and I would include both of us in this, are obsessed with the current occupant in the White House.
Yes.
So in the present moment, and the current election, the nominating process on the Democrats.
We're all following
it. So we're all following it, you know, every ebb and turn, and boy, Elizabeth Warren, what a performance the other night. Anyway, so we think high politics is fine in our own lives, but we disdain it, or the academy disdains it when writing about the past. I think there's a disconnect there, frankly. But I think there's an but I also think, more importantly, there's an opportunity to talk about big ideas and reach a wider audience when writing about these topics. I'm not writing a celebratory book about Washington and Jefferson. It's an opportunity to talk about things like indigenous people, slavery, what was the revolution about. And I think these are important things. Let us not forget that Mount Vernon and Monticello are two of the best documented slave plantations in the history of slavery in the Western Hemisphere.
Sure.
And simply saying, oh, we don't work on them because they're Washington and Jefferson, is a mistake.
Yes. Okay. So, I mean, I think the response I think some people get to these kinds of books is some of them, and obviously your book is not going to be like this, but some of them really are so intensely biographical that they do sort of forget the rest of the world these people live in.
Right.
You know, and I think that the trick is, as you point out, to write about Washington and the way he's in, like Calloway's book, where he's Washington and Native Americans, where the Native Americans are actors independent with their own agencies and agendas and thoughts, and it's not simply about
Washington. Colin is primarily a historian of Native Americans,
right? Because some of these biographies, the sort of trope that some people get of popular biographies is they really are about the sort of minutia of the person's everyday life, and the Parson Weems kind of biography that's really sort of, here's why you should love George Washington.
Or my book is as yet untitled. If anybody has a suggestion, I need help because I need a compelling title, but I do not want something that is of the genre of Washington and Jefferson, the men who made America.
Yes.
Because first of all, I'd probably be stripped of my PhD and drummed out of the profession for that. But that's not what the book's about anyway. But that's often the genre. Mm-hmm. That's often what you get. I have toyed with Washington and Jefferson. It's complicated to use the Facebook relationship description. I don't think that'll age very well. But it's pushing back. We have to push back against that kind of history with serious history.
Yes.
That is also engaging and can reach a wider audience.
I think
we make a mistake if we just cede that ground.
I think you're 100% right about that. Because I think it's, there are lots of great academic books that are written that get read by a few thousand people, but really only gets read within the academy.
A few thousand's good, David.
I was talking about the best-selling academic books. The other ones, they're read by 50 people maybe and sit in libraries. And if you have a chance to actually use and sort of leverage your expertise to address a bigger audience that wouldn't necessarily otherwise be interested in these questions, but make them think about them, that's a good thing.
And I am no way opposed to colleagues writing on topics that are totally, and using approaches and methodologies and subjects on that are totally different. Because, I mean, we have to be a broad church.
Yes.
And speak to, and that work is incredibly important. And that work is as important as the work I do. You've got a different approach than I do. And that's fine. That's as it should be. I am in no way saying we should all write presidential history. God help us all.
Oh, yeah.
If that were the case.
Then it'd be a very crowded bookstore.
But I think there's a place for this to be done by scholars.
I think there's a place for everything to be done by scholars.
Right, so, and I think that's important. So that's my defense. There will be people who won't like what I'm doing just because of the subject and won't read it. And that's fine. And then there are going to be, I hope I reach a wide enough audience that I piss some people off because they pick it up expecting one thing and then get something else. Sure. That, if that happens, it's a success. And it's not meant, you know, it's not meant to be, it's certainly not meant to be hagiographic, but nor is it meant to be kind of a revisionist history attacking America. Yeah. You know, that's what Alexis was accused of.
Sure.
And that's a nonsense.
To be sure.
You know, where the historians are not about attacking or defending our subjects, really. We shouldn't be.
Usually not.
Yeah.
All right.
So, anyway.
Well, good luck finishing up this project. And people, if they have titles for Frank, Washington and Jefferson, Founding Frenemies. No, that's something better than that.
Come George and Tom, a love story.
You will get some hate mail when you do that. Yeah, do like a romance novel cover.
That's it. Yeah, with Fabio on the cover.
Would he be George or would he be...
Well, George with those massive thighs. I mean, exactly. It's all about the thighs.
All right, it's time for Last Drop, Frank. What you got?
I want to go back to where we began and give a shout-out to our colleague Rachel Hosker in the Center for Research Collections here at the University of Edinburgh, but to also give a more general shout-out to the Center for Research Collections and especially the Lang Collection. So the letter in question that I discussed on the BBC with Rachel from Washington is in something called the Lang Collection. And the Lang Collection is a huge collection of works related... not only to America, but I can't remember Lang's first name. This is terrible. Mr. Lang, who created this collection and
collected these papers
during the 19th century, was interested in America, among other things, and he just hoovered up stuff, really. And Rachel took me into the vault in the Center for Research Collections the other day to just kind of pull stuff off the shelf and look at them.
Going in the vault, that's a special privilege.
It's amazing. So we looked at a packet of letters from the governor of West Florida, the Scottish governor of West Florida in the early 1760s.
Huh.
So, and there is a ton of stuff in the Lang Collection related to America and the United States and its antecedents that are worth looking at. There was a pack of letters about Jamaica, for example. And there's a kind of Scottish-American dimension to most of this stuff. There's an account from Adam Ferguson, predecessor here at this university, but Ferguson also served on the Carlisle Commission, which sought to negotiate a peace between the infant United States and Britain in 1778 to bring the War of Independence to a close unsuccessfully. There's all kinds of stuff in there, very, very rich. It's a shout out to Rachel and her colleagues at the CRC, but I guess more generally to archivists everywhere.
Yes.
They're your friends, historians.
They are your friends.
And talk to them and ask them what they
think. It's always weird how stuff ends up in strange places that you would think that all the George Washington stuff would be in Virginia and it's scattered all over the world and you never know where things are going to end up.
Yeah, and they're still finding stuff, which is great. So,
which is, anyway. Yeah, so,
what about you, David? What's yours?
So there was a news story earlier this week that's connected with George Washington that I thought was an interesting little thing to think about and read about. At Mount Vernon in the gift shop there, they were selling, I guess it was a fridge magnet, essentially, of a replica of George Washington's false teeth that one could sort of buy to, I guess, hold children's pictures up on your fridge or whatever people use fridge magnets for. But what some historians online, in particular Ana Lucia Araujo at Howard University, pointed out is that, you know, most people think George Washington's teeth were wood.
Wooden teeth.
Yeah, it turns out they weren't wooden. Some of them were animal teeth, and some of them were teeth of enslaved people, which is kind of a creepy thing when you think about it.
Yeah, I mean, Alexis writes about this in her book.
And she pointed this out to Mount Vernon that as something attached to Washington people are familiar with, his teeth are pretty famous, but it's also kind of problematic, to put it mildly, that these are also sort of symbols of his power as a slaveholder and his exploitation of enslaved people. And Mount Vernon said, oh, that's a really good point. They pulled it from this gift shop. So it's an interesting way about thinking about where these public spaces are and the ways in which they respond to suggestions from the public and from academics and all kinds of things.
Yeah, I mean, the institutional response
was great.
Was quick and very... And
they weren't defensive about it?
No, they said, you're right, we're really sorry.
Yeah, one can see how that would end up in a gift shop because George Washington teeth are quite famous. I remember seeing them at the Smithsonian when I was a kid and saying, that's really cool. And then when you sort of think about where this product came from, it becomes this more problematic kind of...
That's right. Yeah. And they responded. But one thing, if I can add a postscript to your postscript, yes, about Washington's teeth. Now, Washington has this reputation, especially when he's president, for being quite austere.
Yes.
And aloof and not very welcoming. He's in pain a lot because his teeth... He's got like one tooth left at that point. And his dentures are incredibly notwithstanding their provenance, which is a problem. But he's in a lot of pain. And one reason he doesn't smile is because he has no teeth.
Yes.
And we forget...
And why he doesn't give a lot of public speeches.
Right. You know, exactly. And we forget the fact that like these kind of individual circumstances actually affect how people live their day-to-day lives. So, the Washington of the dollar bill is the guy with no teeth.
Okay.
We need to bear that in mind, maybe.
All right. So everybody floss, too. So
yeah. Teeth.
Cheers.
Cheers, David.
The Whiskey Rebellion is hosted by David Silkenet and Frank Cogliano. David is a senior lecturer in American history at the University of Edinburgh, and Frank is professor of American history and Dean International for North America at the University of Edinburgh. The Whiskey Rebellion is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podbean. You can follow the show on Twitter at Whiskey Rebel Pod and like the show on Facebook for updates about current and future episodes.